Cordy.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Big Travel Podcast, exploring life stories through travel. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. Travelling the breadth of the UK in her enviable job as the presenter of BBC One's Escape to the Country is more calming than Sonali Shah's previous travels, which included making a kidnap plan when filming in Afghanistan, needing armed guards at her wedding in Kenya, and being stuck in a military coup in Bangkok. With family from Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, and India, she's a true child of the Commonwealth and also a Londoner through and through. Please welcome the very well-travelled Sonali Shah.
I'm Sonali Shah. I'm a journalist, a broadcaster, a presenter on TV and radio. A Londoner through and through in many ways. Born in London, the first from both sides of the family to have been born in the UK, I think, and brought up in the UK, my brother and I. So an East African Asian family, both my parents born in East Africa, all grandparents born in India. So I'm a child of the Commonwealth, I would say.
Were they like my family? My dad's an Indian Fijian, although he never went to India as a child and he was second or third generation. Was that as a product of indentured labour? Do you know about indentured labour?
No, it was my grandparents, in particular my grandfather's, going to East Africa for the economic opportunities. So generations before them, people had gone to build the railroads under the British Empire. But when it comes to my grandparents, who, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, at different times, it was all for economic reasons to set up their own businesses. They'd heard of this country or these countries, Kenya and Tanzania, and actually Uganda on my father-in-law's side, and knew of the opportunities and never really looked back.
Like many Indians, they go, and whether they're at a disadvantage or on the back foot to start with, they really knuckle down, don't they?
Oh, work ethic is phenomenal, and that has run through to today. You know, you're embarrassing if you don't work hard. It doesn't matter if you don't do well, but if you don't work hard, that's a family embarrassment, isn't it? And I think that's a good attitude to have.
I think it is a good attitude to have, and it really frustrates me when, luckily not the majority of people, but when people around the world sort of complain about immigration. Coming from an immigrant family, at least on one half, for me, my father, I find that very insulting when you know that, you know, often these people are the hardest workers there are because they've got to strive, they've got to prove something, and they have to survive, I guess.
They have to prove something to everyone. They have to prove something to their family back home because they were the chosen people to be sent out to another country. So my father was the one out of four that was sent to Britain to study. So he had to prove himself because to earn that right. My mother fought to come to Britain. Now, everyone was born British under British rule. So I've come from three generations of British people, but because they were all born under British rule. But both of them had to prove something to their families. And then you have that feeling of proving something to people here. And they felt they had to be better to be treated the same as everyone else around them.
So what did they do when they came over?
Both of them studied. So in fact, my parents met at around Bradford. My dad was studying pharmacy at Bradford University. He actually did his A-levels in a year because I don't think he could afford to do it over 2 years. So he did them in a year and then started studying pharmacy at Bradford University. Although everyone back home in Tanzania, his parents were confused because they thought he was studying how to be a farmer. And they were like, why did we send you all the way to Britain to study what our ancestors did in India? And my mum studied at a nursing college to become a midwife. And that's where they met. So I'm a sort of product of India, East Africa and Yorkshire.
Was it an arranged marriage or did they?
No. They just met. They met and actually, I think, dated for a few years before telling their families. But all sides have always got on. And the only problem was the Kenya-Tanzania border and trying to get married and crossing the border and all of that. But apart from that, you know, all was well, actually.
So did you grow up in what we might call a British Asian community?
My parents had moved to London before I was born and lived in Harrow, which was now is probably more Asian. At the time, the area we lived in, Harrow, wasn't hugely Asian, so there were a few Asian people around. More people had moved to perhaps Wembley and other parts of Harrow. But I certainly felt both sides and knew both sides. I grew up speaking Gujarati. English is not my first language. I only started speaking that at about three when I went to nursery. It was just integrated in the sense that I didn't... Yes, at times I felt different when my mum would maybe give me different food in my lunchbox. You know, and if I got called the P word at school in the playground, I just gave everyone a geography lesson in a kind of really faux naive way, saying, well, actually, my family's not from Pakistan, it's from India, and let me explain the geography to you. And by the time I explained it, they would just give up the bullying because, you know, and I knew what they were getting at, but I just thought there's no way to try and fight back. Just try and fight back with a bit of knowledge and let's see if that just shuts them down. And I think they just got bored of my explanations.
It's such a minefield, that one, isn't it? Because you protest that you're not from somewhere if someone does use the P word. And but actually, what's wrong with being from somewhere?
No, it's just, it's my so only difficult. Way of trying to... you can't reason with people who want to hurt you, really. So I just sort of bored them. Submission, I think. But I was very much aware of both cultures, mainly because of language. And I went to a Saturday Gujarati school. I learnt a lot of Indian dancing. I was firmly had a foot in both camps. I loved having two wardrobes growing up. And the Indian wedding, sometimes explaining, you know, Indian weddings to people and how they go on for days and days and all of that back in the day.
So did you wear Indian dress at home?
No, not at all. No, only for weddings. So it was very much, my grandparents weren't in this country. They were in Kenya and Tanzania. So I never had, it was always, everything was quite Western. And my mum moved here at 17. She spent, you know, more years here than she ever did anywhere else. And so in that sense, we were just a very much a typical English family. Just happened to speak another language too, and my parents also speak Swahili on top of that. And maybe food-wise, it was a bigger deal because, you know, I weaned both my children on curry as well, and we're all vegetarians, and maybe that was the only difference. Now everyone's a vegetarian or a vegan, so it hardly makes a difference, especially in London. But I think those differences I hardly noticed, to be honest. I loved being part of two cultures, actually.
And did you go back to, or go back, because you weren't returning yourself, but did your parents take you back to Africa?
Go back is something I'm actually fine with, because in many ways that was back home. I'm very much a Londoner, English, British. I was born in London. This feels like home. I always say London is the best city in the world. I love travelling, but I genuinely believe I'm in love with London. That's an odd thing to say, I think, but I just love this city and I love coming back home. My grandparents lived in Kenya and Tanzania, and so that was family, and that was where all my cousins were. They weren't here. We had very few people here family wise so every summer was spent, the 6-week holiday, my mum would take us to her mum and her mother-in-law, and we would go for 6 weeks to Kenya and Tanzania, and my dad would join us for two of those weeks when he could get time off work. But that was how an easier way to occupy us for, you know, she had no help here, so occupy us for 6 weeks. So my first trip back home was when I was 4 months old for a family wedding. Every summer was East Africa. So I certainly felt an affiliation to that. Where I didn't feel any connection to for a very long time was India, where people here would see me of Indian origin looking at my skin. But I didn't go to India till 1999, till I was 19 years old, the millennium, over that new year. And it was a shock. Everyone looks like you. Wow. Everyone speaks the same language as you, although obviously English is my strongest language and has been for many years. But the fact that everyone spoke
it's very
language
strange.
Just like you. And
I remember arriving at the airport for the first time in India, and I have no family in India these days. They're all from Fiji. They're Fiji Indians. And my dad doesn't have any family in India that he knows of. Obviously, there's going to be relations somewhere along the line. But a landing in the airport, even one of the porters that was carrying someone's luggage went, "Indian girl." That was the first thing he said. And it's so incredible to see people that have your features, and but to not feel connected to them, or to feel a certain amount of
but
connection.
Still feel like an outsider.
Yes,
like
exactly.
People can tell by the way you dress, and obviously by the way you speak. And I found myself trying to take on a lilt sometimes so that people could understand my English a bit better. And so if you heard me in India, I put on an Indian accent just so everyone can understand. But also maybe it helps the bargaining when you're shopping.
Even it's like the same when you go to America and you find yourself saying tomato because yes, nobody understands yes, you and you say tomato and
light
water
a lot. Yes. Yeah, but I have that. I think they call it a sympathy sort of talk where I take on the accent of the person I'm speaking to. So I do sound different if I'm speaking to my mum. And it's just involuntary.
So describe to me your favourite place to visit in East Africa.
It probably has to be the coast because those are the memories. Although, so Nairobi was where my mum's family was from and I loved hanging out with all my cousins there. And my dad's side is from Tanzania, so sort of the foothills of Mount Kilimanjaro. You can see Kilimanjaro from my grandparents' house, from their living room. It was so usual to just have it as a backdrop. It almost felt fake. But I ended up getting married in Mombasa. I met my husband at a wedding in Rajasthan, and weddings as well as work have taken me around the world, destination weddings. And one of the deals when he proposed to me was, you know, let's get married, but it has to be in Kenya where he grew up. He spent the first 11 years of his life in Kenya and he wanted to get married back home as such. So I love the coast of Kenya and the white sands and the, you know, crystal clear waters, and it's just with a bit of seaweed, a sprinkling of seaweed. I just love that because that's where I grew up with my family. Those were our holidays, the cottages. And yes, they've become a bit more luxury and as we've, you know, started to work and afford it, but it just has so many memories throughout my life and they continue. And I've taken my daughter there. She's now 4.5. I took her when she was 2 to meet her great grandmother, but I need to take my son and I need to take both of them to meet my dad's mum as well.
Do you think it would be hard going there with children, or you'd be okay because you've got lots of family support?
It's just the malaria factor. So that's the only reason why I haven't gone yet. You have to wait till 2 if you want them to take malaria tablets. So it's just being a bit more health conscious. You know, I don't think our parents thought about all of that when we were kids. We just went. But now we're a bit more conscious of everything. And so, yeah, if we can sneak in a few malaria tablets and the Nutella for my son, we'll take him when he's 2.
Where have you been through work?
Oh my gosh. Afghanistan was particularly memorable, only because it's not somewhere you would necessarily go unless work took you. You know, I don't know anyone that's gone there on holiday as such.
Sadly, because it used to be the most beautiful country and I've read so many books about
it. Absolutely. And you can see that beauty through all the destruction, actually, when you go there, the mountains. I went there to film a couple of documentaries about children who'd always grown up in a war zone. Haiti was my first experience of the Caribbean, actually, through work after the earthquake. And again, this is where the Clintons honeymooned. This was a place that was a destination place for those beach holidays, and the Haiti I saw was just obviously nothing like that. I went out to film some newsround specials. China, I went through work again after the earthquake there in the Sichuan province, and then I went on to report on the Beijing Olympic Games. And that was my first experience really of really reporting on sport. I'd never thought about it before. I was always a sports fan growing up. You know, I started supporting Arsenal in 1996 when Arsene Wenger came onto the scene. So actually it's a
bit strange. You're feeling a bit heartbroken now that he's gone.
That's all I've ever known. So it is a strange time. At least we can now celebrate him because actually there's been some, you know, finger out things for so long. At least now we can just celebrate and appreciate what he's done for the club. So Beijing was great. And then the triathlon series. I used to cover triathlon for BBC Sport. And that's like the Formula One circuit, but just not on that glamorous level. But, you know, it took me around the world. It took me to New Zealand. It took me to Canada. It took me to San Diego. And then many places across Europe, you know, places like Stockholm that I hadn't thought of visiting, but amazing places that are just these great cities around the world where triathlon is huge.
Where have you felt most out of your comfort zone?
It's got to be the tough trips. Maybe Afghanistan, only because I knew the burden that it had on everyone back home, having to go on a hostile environment course and learning what to do if you are kidnapped and making sure there are answers to your kidnap questions back home with only one person if something happens to you. And all those, the preparation for a trip like that, you know, I just applaud anyone who works in a war zone. The preparation for a trip like that is like nowhere else, just because I think at the time Kabul was due an attack as well, and the way you have to go in with protection and things like that. I felt aware all the time of my presence. Yes, I sort of looked like people there when I went, and I wore a hijab the whole time out of respect while I was reporting, but then I was also with a camera crew and we were clearly foreigners, therefore attracting attention. And it's you can't really be incognito and you don't know how people are feeling about you and you're clearly British, and having to put the camera down every time there are American helicopters ahead in case people think it's an RPG. So just that was, you know, a real learning curve. And I was offered the chance to go back to Afghanistan a few months later, but this time to be embedded with British troops in Camp Bastion, and I had to turn it down. That was the first time I realised I have to start putting family first, and that was before I'd had kids. But I could see my in-laws are really, really stressed, and I thought, do I put them through this again? Do I chance my luck again? I really wanted to go, but I thought, I've got to not be selfish here. And that was the first time I had to learn how not to be selfish with work. And then obviously having kids really, really teaches you that. And it's frustrating at times.
You hadn't necessarily planned to be a war reporter, and that is a step, you know, following around the troops and everything is a step too far, I think.
Well, compared in many ways, I think that would have been safer than Kabul, because Kabul, you're on your own, but you can't assess the risk. And I just think so soon, had it been maybe a year later, I think so soon after the first trip, it was just stressing family out a little bit more. And I think as if you're a journalist, you just want, you're nosy and you want to just find out things, and that overpowers any other fear, really.
So what was it like there? Describe Kabul to me. Describe Afghanistan.
Gosh, rubble. A lot of rubble everywhere, actually. And there are mines everywhere, cluster bombs everywhere, that these kids in classes are taught how to... They look out for the signs of it. But, remember, these children have not known any different. It has been years of war after war after war, and they don't know any different. And it's really usual to see troops walking around. It's really usual to see foreign armies in. And I just can't believe that's how they grow up every day. Other people have gone through it, be it the Troubles in Ireland, or other communities have gone through this. And I just think sometimes we don't appreciate how lucky we are not to have gone through that in many ways.
Where have you felt most comfortable and happy, apart from your home countries?
South Africa was a big deal to visit, only because East Africa is always home, and people always said South Africa feels nothing like the rest of Africa. It feels like Europe in Africa, and actually that's a great description of it in many ways. We did the garden route. I loved the fact, actually, it was Europe in Africa. You had all the beauty of Africa and the safaris. One of my favourite things to do, and still my favourite holidays, is safari, and where I want to take my kids. I went when I was pregnant. I absolutely will never get bored of going on safari. And what I loved about South Africa is you didn't have to worry about your health in terms of, yes, safety is a huge aspect, but there's no malaria on that route or anything like that. Well, everything I was used to thinking about in East Africa and the conveniences of Europe, but in Africa. So I loved that. But I loved going to Brazil. I've loved Japan. I went with work, and it's just another world. And what I found hilarious is going to Japan, and from the back, everyone thinks you're Japanese because I'm small with dark hair. So it's only when I turn around, people sort of look at you, not expecting you to look how you look.
You see a shock registered on their face.
Yeah, honestly, you can see that, you know, if you're sort of taller with white skin, people can sort of see that coming from a mile off. But with me, I used to surprise people as I turned around, because apparently from the back, I looked East Asian as well. So I found that quite amusing. But I just absolutely love travelling. I was counting up the countries last night. I don't even think I've got them all, but, you know, on honeymoon we went to Thailand and Cambodia. But weddings have taken us around the world, which is brilliant.
I love this. I'm very jealous because nobody's getting married in my life at the moment. And I myself got married in Spain, which was wonderful because instead of just having a day like you would at home, you've got a whole week with all your best friends and family there in the
everyone's
world.
Everyone's relaxed.
Everyone's having a party. Everyone's dressed in beautiful, bright colours, and you know, there's fabulous food and wine, and it's just the most
beautiful
experience.
No one has to go
experience.
To work the next day or the day after.
Exactly.
And that's the advantage. That's what we wanted. But also we had lots of guests from East Africa and an elderly, grandparents as well. So we wanted to make it as easy as possible.
So where have you been? Where's been the most fabulous wedding that you've attended abroad?
Probably one of the most spectacular was Rajasthan. A friend of mine got married out there. It was so palatial, that's why. And that was my first experience of Rajasthan. My only experience. I've got a lot more to explore. I think that you can't beat Rajasthan if you want those palaces. And that's why so many people now get married there. This was, more than 10 years ago when I went for a wedding out there. But it was just amazing. But what I love about my own wedding in East Africa is I genuinely enjoyed it. I felt like I was on holiday. I remember it. I wasn't stressed out about it. We did quite a few trips out there to plan it, and everyone was in holiday mode. And almost the wedding was incidental, it was just part of a massive party. And I'd love that. I'm about to go to Greece for a wedding. Join me.
I will. I'm there. Yeah,
so that's my next, it's Salonika. So that'll be my first experience of a wedding in Greece and a Greek Orthodox wedding as well.
Oh, I'm
so
visualising Mamma Mia. Yeah, it's going to be amazing.
In my head, that's how it's going to be.
So. Are you taking the kids?
Yeah, I'm taking the kids. Let's see how it all goes because it's an evening wedding. But
have you found that travel has changed with now you've got children?
Yes. You know, I went whitewater rafting from the source of the Nile in Uganda and gorilla trekking in Uganda and whitewater rafting in Seattle in America and in Australia as well. I'd love a bit of adventure along with relaxing as well. I love cities. It's just not practical with children, is it? Travel has most certainly changed. There was a lot more long haul before the kids, trying to get in as much travel in as possible, trying to soak up the world, really. And there's so many more places on my list. But at the moment, I think it's got to be short haul. I just don't want to do long flights. My kids are great sleepers, but in a bed, they're not great sleepers unless we fly business class. And that's not where I want to go. And can't afford anyway. And
you might want to go there,
but you know, and if I do, I'm not paying for the kids to also be
they can go
up
back
in the front of the plane. Exactly.
No,
I'm quite aware I don't want them to constantly have these luxurious holidays only because that's what I might want from a holiday at the moment, because I just need a break. We have gone to Dubai a couple of times, once for a wedding but also once just with the family, and I can completely see why. They're great holidays. Everything's sort of set up for you. But I think we'd like to try something a little bit more adventurous than that sort of sanitized world. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's an easy holiday. It's relaxing. You know everything's catered for. So this year, yes, we'll go to the wedding in Greece, but we're trying to do a bit of Spain and a bit of France in Egypt and seeing if that kind of works out with the kids. But, you know, at the moment, they don't sleep in the same room as us and all of that. So we can't get just one hotel room. It's really difficult. So we're at that funny phase where we have to sort of do very short haul. And because we're all vegetarian, Italy's amazing. We took my daughter to Venice and that was just great, staying in the Lido. It's a lot of Europe and probably a lot of Italy, really, just wherever's family friendly. But Europe isn't cheap either, is it?
Well, it's not cheap, no, but the advantage we have from over here is that you can get there quickly and easily, if not cheaply, especially now you're working on school hours like I am. That really sort of clips
absolutely.
Your wings.
We are tied into school holidays, and I think trying to find those, I'm trying to rediscover Europe in a different way, maybe within the way. My parents didn't take us to Europe that often because we were always in East Africa, so we did the odd Butlins and the odd Pontins and all those kind of holidays as a kid, or when people visited we would go up to Blackpool maybe, and you know, really lovely simple holidays. We never did the camping thing because it's sort of an alien, you know, we now do glamping in East Africa, but it's a really alien concept culturally, I think, for a lot of Asian families, because, well, as my husband says, why go somewhere worse than your own house? That's not a holiday. But you know, we grew up having to go to the loo in East Africa in a hole. People didn't have stand-up toilets, so people forget that. That's how we've grown up on holiday. So now the idea of going to a festival and maybe going to the loo in that way is just not—it's not aspirational, and you know,
I'm not a camper as such. My parents were campers, and our holidays every year we're driving down to the south of France, and we had a camper van, and we'd pitch up a tent. I did nothing. I was just sitting there, and that's how I would be now going camping. The only time I've camped is at Glastonbury or festivals, and I've let whoever I'm with do it.
If it's without the kids, then I'd do it, but I'm not sure with the kids. But then, you know, we've done the sort of posher tents in East Africa, and I like that way of doing safari as well, where it feels a bit raw, but you know, someone puts in some hot water into your personal shower in the morning, so that's quite nice.
You have never been glamping. I do like the idea of it.
It's really nice. It's a nice way of sort of appreciating the Rift Valley. Tanzanian safaris are amazing. Like the Ngorongoro crater is, I would highly recommend that. And it's kind of, people talk about Kenya a lot, but that Ngorongoro crater is you're guaranteed to see game, and it's just stunning. But safari all over East Africa, you absolutely can't beat. But now I'm spending a lot of time, bear in mind, through Escape to the Country, exploring the UK.
Oh, yes. Let me explain. Well, explain to me Escape to the Country, because it's a great programme. It's probably one of my ideal programmes to
present myself. It's a lot of people's sort of guilty pleasure at 3 p.m, isn't it? I just look at properties for a living now. It's amazing. I go around the country showing people properties for BBC One.
It's a daytime BBC programme.
Yeah, exactly, at 3 o'clock. It's on every day, and so we film a lot during the year. And I go away for 3 nights a week to film each episode, but the whole episode takes a week, actually, to film. there's a lot that goes into it, and people genuinely move. And I've been revisiting people recently who move. And what's been nice about it, in so many, property's always been a personal passion. I've always had a dream to build my own home one day, and hopefully I will. And what's great about this job is that it's taking me around the UK, which I didn't really do as a child, because all our money was always on going back home to the grandparents. So I'm exploring the UK now and visiting places that I haven't been myself through a school trip.
And it's beautiful. We're
so
lucky.
So glorious.
The only thing is the weather. That's the only thing that's wrong with the UK.
Yes, and that's, you can't predict. Well, I think before it was okay because there were four definite seasons and you'd always been dressed right. I think recently it's quite worrying what we're seeing with climate change, and you can't predict the seasons anymore and just the different weather patterns going on. And that is a bit strange, and that makes it harder, therefore, to plan a holiday in the UK. But maybe that's the case all over the world. I don't think, you know, we were stuck in a windstorm in Dubai in February when it's meant to be quite okay. So I don't think you can predict the weather anywhere.
I think it's changing everywhere. It's really surprising and worrying, very worrying.
It is. And we had that heat wave in April, didn't we? I think let's all try and do what we can. And there are places that, you know, I've never been to the Maldives, and you hear about that it might not exist in years to come. And there are places I want to visit, but it's really sad when you hear things like that. There are communities who are really up against it a lot more than we are.
Tell me about some places you've been in the UK on Escape to the Country.
Oh, well, everyone's favourite are always Devon or Cornwall. There's a lot of people who want to move there. I've been to Norfolk a lot. People love the accessibility to the coast and the Peak District. Of course, there's just the dry stone walls. People love dry stone walls. Chatsworth House and all of that.
Oh,
but it's
amazing.
Been so lovely to visit it again.
Those big old country houses,
oh,
that's
amazing.
What people think when they think of England. If they're not thinking of London, they think of beautiful rolling green fields and those big old country houses.
And that's why I love the job, because you get to see the best parts of Britain, really, because people are wanting to move to somewhere beautiful, and because they're perhaps where they live now in a suburb it's just a little bit too busy for them. And so trying to find someone a property in those surroundings is just amazing. So
I've always wondered how much involved the presenter is in finding the property, or do you just turn up and talk?
No, it's a research team. So it's a research team that find, because they have to find it the week before or the few weeks before. They have to be houses that are genuinely on the market at the time, and sometimes houses are bought while we're securing other houses. And so it's quite a lot of work that goes into each episode that I hope people appreciate, and lots of people do buy them.
They actually buy a house that you've shown them.
And inevitably, you know, a lot of the time it's the mystery house, because you're taking them to somewhere that they wouldn't have necessarily gone to see themselves.
I think I need this service myself. Can I do it without being on TV?
Yeah, go on. Yeah, absolutely. So many people say that to me, actually. They just don't want to be on the TV side of things.
I'm on TV anyway, but not in that capacity.
No, you don't want to be personally.
Yeah, it feels a bit
I need to start a celebrity version of it.
Yes, though. Yeah. I'm a very
There's a celebrity version of many other shows, so maybe there needs to be celebrity.
I'll tell you what, I'm only very much the Z-list on the celebrity scale, but I'd be up for
Where would you move in the country?
We're looking at Sussex, but probably more Brighton than Sussex, so that's not really the country.
No.
You might throw me a wild card away. The mystery house.
This is a more rural part of Hove, maybe.
So what haven't I asked you? What stories do you have from travelling? Have you ever had anything terrifying or negative happen to you?
Oh, gosh, in Thailand. Sometimes we look at each other, my husband and I, and just say, oh, this will be our luck. But in Thailand, well, it was Bangkok. We couldn't get out of the country because there was a coup going on, as you do. So we kind of knew things were rumbling while we were in our hotel in Bangkok. And then we got a phone call from the airline saying we're not really sure if we're able to fly out of the airports and things like that. And it was just this mad thing of let's just head to the airport and see what happens. And then we were just sort of on the tarmac, you know, not very secure tarmac, where people were handing out written out paper tickets. So no level of security. And you're just trying to get on the first plane out of there. It's just a weird experience of getting caught up in trouble. Tsunami warnings when we were in Malaysia, I think. Pretty scary, because it was after the major. We had gone out to, in fact, our Thailand trip, we went to stay at a place that had been rebuilt after the 2006 tsunami. And because we wanted to support that kind of hotel and the workers that had lost their families that were now working at this hotel, to get then caught up subsequently in a tsunami warning where you're being told to go up onto higher ground. And that's just, you just can't imagine what people who had lived through that huge tsunami had gone through, but you're just more aware of all of this now, aren't you?
Yes, I mean, I've been to all those places in Thailand particularly that were affected by the tsunami, but pre-tsunami. So to then watch it on TV, it was just shocking, knowing, you know, thinking, well, where would you run to? You know, like Koh Phi Phi, there's a bit of higher ground, but it's, you have to sort of get through the little shacks and villages and bars and restaurants, really fabulous little area to get to this higher ground. And you just, people wouldn't have had the warning because they wouldn't have expected it.
And no, and it's very usual before that tsunami happened, it's very usual to see big waves and you didn't think anything of it. But now I'm really aware, I look out and I always look at the waves and I am so aware if I'm in that part of the world, well, where, what's happening? Does it look unusual? Let's make sure we know where higher ground is.
A story that always sticks out to me, I think it was a British girl, but there was a girl who was at school age, sort of 8, 9, 10, and she actually told her parents that the wave was coming because she had learnt something about it in school, learnt something about bubbles, learnt something about the tide going out unexpectedly, quickly and quite dramatically, and she actually warned her parents. And it's things like that when you're in those places now, you sort of look for these signs that, you know, something might go amiss.
We were in South Africa after there was a British couple and on honeymoon, and the newlywed wife had been killed, and we went out there just after that, and lots of people were looking at us because they were of Asian origin too, and sort of kept asking us, "Do you know them?" And so that holiday was sort of
actually you don't look unlike her, you know, knowing and from lots, what I knew.
We were in similar sort of areas, and we would have never visited a township, and it, likewise when we went to Rio, we wouldn't have gone to a favela. When we were in, you know, Mumbai, we don't go to the slums because I don't like the idea of staring at people in their homes like that, you know. But only because maybe I've grown up in East Africa where you've seen poverty around you, and maybe you're a little bit not as aware of it, or, you know, just more used to seeing it. I don't know. But yeah, that was a strange holiday to where people kept asking you about that case, and some parts of it just didn't feel right because you're in a bar and then people will just ask you about that. But you're quite aware of how unsafe parts of South Africa are. But, you know, in East Africa, at the time of our wedding, we had to really rearrange a few things. The election had happened. There was a lot of bloodshed. We were very close to cancelling the wedding. People advised us, actually, cancel it. Don't take out, you know, 100 people from the UK, you know, who are all paying for themselves to come out to your wedding. Don't ask them to come out there. But we contacted the hotel and we really felt that if we didn't continue with the wedding out there, that all those people wouldn't have work for the wedding in that hotel. And actually, as it turns out, when we went to the hotel, they were on skeleton staff and a lot of people had already had to go back to their villages because there wasn't enough money to pay them because so many people had pulled out of their holidays. And so we're really glad we didn't. But it did mean that we had a few pullouts for the wedding. People, I guess, who don't necessarily know East Africa, didn't have family out there, were a bit nervous, understandably, and they'd have every right to. But also we ended up having to go to Diani Beach in Mombasa. You have to, if you fly into the main Mombasa airport, you have to take a ferry across, and then there's a car journey, a sort of hour's car journey. We had to provide armed guards for people because that's what we were advised, that if you don't, people won't feel safe. And it felt like a bit over the top, but it was just what the travel company sort of advised us.
And how did your British friends, who had never been to Africa,
to be honest, most, they just kind of went with it. I think they knew from, we wouldn't have asked people to go out if we thought it was unsafe. And so we said, look, we really feel it's safe, but you've got to make your own decision. And I think a lot of people, you know, felt a bit better that they were armed guards, but we just didn't know how to balance out having this wedding and wanting to make sure that we were helping people out and feeding into the economy, and also having planned this wedding ourselves, there's selfish reasons in that too, and people's safety and everything, which is paramount. Then what you see on the news isn't what's happening everywhere.
Yeah,
it's pockets of violence, and you know, we had local knowledge and we had that understanding of where not to go.
There's people that are afraid of coming to London.
Yes. And I remember at the time of me going to Afghanistan, some of the interviews I was doing out there, they were saying at the time, well, Kabul is safer than parts of Glasgow or Birmingham or London. And I think that you can get caught up in something anywhere, and that's the reality of the world. It's just being aware and not taking unnecessary risks.
On a lighter note, I'm going to bring you to my last question, which is about music, because I always ask a last question about music. I think music and travel often go hand in hand. We have the time to listen when we're on journeys, and it helps evoke and cement memories and bring up all sorts of emotions. And so if you had to choose one song that reminded you of a special time or a memorable time when you've been travelling on your travels, What would that song be?
You can't ask me about one song, can
I know,
you?
Because I
music is such a huge part of our lives, and everyone's a dancer in the family, so it's on all the time, all day, every day. So it's difficult. There are so many memories with different pieces of music. I probably should choose something like, oh, my wedding dance in East Africa, but I'm not going to actually, because what a really memorable experience for me actually was when I was in Brazil, in Rio, and just forgetting that that's where The Girl from Ipanema was written. And I had grown up playing the steel pans in a steel band, you know, performing in places like the Royal Albert Hall. I was in an orchestra, but I was I played the tenor steel pan. And having always played The Girl from Ipanema on the steel pans, and then ending up in Brazil and just randomly walking past this cafe and realising, oh my gosh, this is where it was written. So that was a really nice moment for me, because it just took me back to when I used to perform Girl from Ipanema in the Royal Albert Hall, and now I was in Rio. It looks like how it does in the pictures, doesn't it? It's such a beautiful city, and I know there are problems there, and people do feel unsafe, and you hear so many stories, but it's also a city well worth visiting.
I'd love to hear The Girl from Ipanema on the pan. What are they called? Pan drums?
Steel pans.
I'd love to hear The Girl from Ipanema.
I hope I would still remember it if I came across a steel pan. I used to own a steel pan. I don't know what we've done with it.
Can you not practice on like a bin at home?
Well, you've got to have all the notes. This is a bit more sophisticated than that. You've got to have all the notes.
But... showing my steel pan ignorance. Thank
well,
you so much.
Well, I suspect
much.
Most people have that.
Yes.
It's an unusual instrument.
It's a great,
instrument
it's a great sound, though. It's a that's lovely sound.
That's in the harmonium. So the two instruments I grew up playing, people are like, what? I like that they're from around the world.
Oh no, it's a lovely sound, really lovely sound. Thank you so much for coming on the Big Travel Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Sonali, and thank you for listening to the Big Travel Podcast. Coming up in the next week, we have a Father's Day special, so look out for that one. And in the meantime, thanks again for listening. See you soon.